From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dead Man Walking, Sister Helen Prejean's memoir about counseling inmates on Louisiana's death row, has been made into a new film starring Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview with Sister Helen Prejean. Also, an interview with Ian McKellen. He's starring in a film adaptation of Shakespeare's Richard III. McKellen is one of Britain's most acclaimed actors and possibly the first openly gay man to be knighted in England. And Stephen Schiff reviews the new futuristic film, 12 Monkeys, directed by Terry Gilliam. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The House has overwhelmingly passed the GOP plan to recall furloughed federal workers and to restore all government employees to the payroll. The measure will pay the workers retroactively to the start of the partial government shutdown and continue their pay through January 26th. The bill will also provide funding for some federal programs, but not others. That means while government employees will be back on the job, many will have nothing to do. The congressional action should provide some relief to furloughed workers such as Marcia King, who works at the Social Security office in Fort Worth, Texas. She told CBS the shutdown has created a hardship for her family.
I am living from day to day. We have to just take one day at a time and just pray that you don't max out our credit cards. And we have a little help from the credit union, but not enough. If we can borrow the money that we were supposed to get for our paycheck, then that will help. But if we don't get paid back, then we'll be owing all that money.
The Senate is expected to add its approval to the legislation later this afternoon. The White House says the resignation of Japanese Prime Minister Tomiichi Murayama will not affect U.S. relations with Tokyo or President Clinton's planned visit to Japan in April. The BBC's Tim Hirsch reports from Tokyo.
The Prime Minister has come under intense pressure in recent months on a series of political and economic problems, most recently over the controversial decision to allocate around $7 billion U.S. dollars of taxpayers' money to bail out creditors of seven failed housing loan companies. Mr. Murayama's resignation would not bring about an immediate election. The start of the new parliamentary session, due in 2 weeks' time, is likely to be brought forward in order for Mr. Hashimoto's succession to be approved.
The BBC's Tim Hirsch. Europe's aviation consortium Airbus Industries says it will redouble its efforts to compete with its chief rival, U.S.-based Boeing. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
A spokesman for Airbus said the company would seek to create new versions of its biggest planes, the A330 and 340, which seat just over 300 passengers. He said the manufacturer would also accelerate studies to develop a large capacity carrier. What the company needs to do most, he said, was to identify deficiencies in its product line and fill the gaps. At the moment, Airbus has nothing to match Boeing's so-called jumbo killer, the 747, which seats 400. Yesterday, Boeing announced that it had sold an extra 85 planes in 1995, giving it a 70% share of the market. Last year, Boeing only had a 60% share, compared to 30% for Airbus. The European consortium would like to take half the market by the year 2000. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently down 15.5 points. This is NPR News. Negotiators for Israel and Syria have ended 3 days of peace talks in Maryland by declaring that they've made progress on the key issues dividing them. U.S. Envoy Dennis Ross, who's been mediating the talks, says all of those involved feel the discussions have been fruitful, constructive, and practical. The State Department has not confirmed statements by the Israelis that the talks will continue later this month after Secretary of State Warren Christopher returns from a trip to the Middle East. NATO troops in Bosnia have engaged in their first exchange of hostile gunfire since the peacekeeping mission began last month. A NATO spokesman says Italian troops in a Serb-controlled suburb of Sarajevo returned fire yesterday after one of their comrades was shot and wounded. From Sarajevo, NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
The Italian soldier was part of a unit based in Vogosca, one of the Serb-controlled suburbs of Sarajevo, due to be turned over to the Muslim Croat Federation. A NATO spokesman says he was shot in the arm while guarding a parking lot near his brigade's local headquarters. Italian troops responded by firing back 4 or 5 times at the position from which the shot came, according to a NATO officer here. There were no further shots. The Italian brigade commander is investigating the incident. British troops also came under indirect fire yesterday when a Royal Air Force plane was hit while taking off from Sarajevo. The source of that firing incident could not be determined. Admiral Leighton Smith, the NATO force commander in Bosnia, called the incidents reprehensible and warned leaders of the warring armies here to discipline their troops and abide by their commitments under the Bosnia Peace Agreement. I'm Tom Gelton, Sarajevo.
A California judge has postponed O.J. Simpson's deposition in the wrongful death civil suit filed against him by the families of murder victims Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. The judge says he needs more time to decide whether the Goldman's attorneys have a conflict of interest in the case. The deposition, when it occurs, will be the first time Simpson has answered questions from attorneys about the murders, which he's been acquitted of committing. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Dead Man Walking stars Susan Sarandon as a nun who counsels men on death row. Sean Penn plays one of the men awaiting execution. The movie is based on a memoir by Sister Helen Prejean. Sean Penn's character is a composite of the men she's worked with. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1993 interview with Sister Helen Prejean. Her prison work dates back to 1982, when she was living and working among the poor in a New Orleans housing project, and a member of the prison commission asked her to correspond with a death row inmate. She started writing Elmo Patrick Saunier, who was convicted of killing 2 young people after abducting them on Lover's Lane. The correspondence led to visits. The visits led to her enduring commitment to men facing execution. Before Saunier was executed, Prejean came to believe in his innocence. She continues to work with death row inmates at the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola and to publicly oppose the death penalty. We talked about her work, and she told me about her very first visit to death row.
I was traumatized by my first visit, I have to tell you. I was frightened. First of all, the sign you read as you go in saying that, you know, by coming onto the prison property, you subject yourself to a strip search and your body cavities and dogs and the whole bit. And it's like it traumatized me. And I kept thinking, oh, God, maybe because I'm a nun, they'll cut me some slack. But I wasn't sure. And then as they brought me into the prison itself and onto death row, just to see the building and know that it was a building devoted to housing people who were condemned to die and waiting to die. And then when I saw, as the guard and I rounded a corner, and there were these red block letters over a green door with bars, and it said death row. I still remember seeing those words for the first time. Like, here is a section where condemned human beings live and wait to die, wait to be killed.
Can you tell us what your first meeting with Saunier was like?
I'll never forget it. I was pacing up and down. Well, they locked me in a room after they had brought me through all these gates, and I was pacing up and down because it was September. It's still hot in Louisiana in September. There's a huge fan going, and I was looking in these 6 booths. They look like telephone booths with heavy mesh wire to separate you from the prisoner. And I was just pacing. I had on my little heels, and I could hear the clop of my heels back and forth on the cement floor. I was a little afraid of him. I'd seen a picture of him, and it had shown him kind of scowling, and the picture had scared me. And I remember thinking, I'm glad he's in prison. I don't want him to be executed, but I'm glad he's in prison. And so I paced up and down and waited, and then I heard his voice coming down the tier with a guard, teasing the guard, because he was a Cajun. I could hear this Cajun French accent. And I heard his voice before I saw him, and I could hear the chains. His legs were shackled. I could hear the chains as they came across the floor. And then I looked up, and there he was. And he had showered, and he was shaved, and his hair was combed, and his face was so open. And it had a kindness in it and a gratitude. And he said, "Sister, I am so glad to see you," because I think he hadn't had a visitor in over 6 or 9 months. And then I eased up a little bit because he was so glad to see someone that he talked a lot. And I realized that all I had to do was really listen and be present to him.
Do you have to believe in somebody's innocence to work with them?
No, in fact, I went in assuming that he was guilty. I go to death row assuming that people are guilty, But to me, one of the moral issues of the death penalty is not so much whether or not we will not execute the innocent, but it's how do we treat the guilty. That, to me, is the moral question that we face with in the death penalty.
You work with prisoners and with families of their victims. Do you sometimes see the prisoners differently after you've spoken with the families of the victims and you've tried to empathize with them and see the crime through their eyes and see the prisoner through their eyes?
Yeah, it produces, I would say that it's probably the worst tension that I've ever felt in my life, is to have been with the victims and known their pain and their grief, and to walk in the room with the person who murdered their child. Because I feel them inside of me, and partly the way I feel their presence is that I have to fight back the guilt of being compassionate to someone who has done so terrible a thing. But the life forces are stronger than the hate forces. And granted, this is easier for me to say than them. If there's a hero in the book, it's Lloyd LeBlanc, who forgave the people who murdered, you know, his son. He knelt by his body's, the son of his body, and said, "Whoever did this, I forgive them." But it's a terrible tension. And I feel in myself the social pressure that the death penalty is. And I can understand how victims' families, they've lost someone they love so much. And here society says to them, "Well, because we value the life of your child, which has been so terribly taken from you, we want to exert the maximum penalty. How do you feel about that?" Well, all that love comes to bear, and you say, "Yes, the maximum penalty," because the maximum penalty is a measure of how much you loved your child. I think the formula gets written out that way, and people respond to that.
Is this the kind of thing you might talk about with parents of victims?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, we talk about everything. I mean, there are two stories I tell in the book were about two people who were executed, Pat Saunier and Robert Lee Willie. Pat Saunier's victim's family, one of the victim's families I have grown close to. With Robert Lee Willie, a young woman was brutally raped and murdered, Faith Hathaway, and her mother, Elizabeth Harvey, and her stepfather, Vernon Harvey. When we would be doing marches and campaigns against the death penalty, the Harveys were always waiting for us at the end of every march we did, and they had a sign that said, "What about the victims?" And Vernon Harvey said to me one time, he said, "Here you are, you've given all your time to these scum. Why don't you come with us to parents of murdered children and come with us to the victims' meetings, and you need to find out what the victims are going through." And he was right, and I went with them. And I was amazed at these meetings that I went to of what the victims' families have suffered. First, I was amazed that they felt abused by the criminal justice system as well as people in prison. Their phone calls weren't returned. In a way, I could see that the prosecutors who were going after the death penalty, it was the state versus the defendant, and the victims were out of the loop of the whole process. And so they didn't know how to deal with victims. Victims are not a vital part of the criminal justice process in prosecuting for the death penalty. And then they had to go through the trial. Of course, DAs, when they press for the death penalty, they want that victim's family there in the courtroom, even if they don't say anything. Their presence say, "Remember us, remember our child," and that's an argument, really silent, but an argument for the death penalty. And I see that the death penalty process, they have to go through the trial and relive it, then they have to wait for the appeals, and it's hard for them to find closure of their grief. It may be delayed 6 years, 7 years, and one of the stories in the book of the Harveys, of Vernon and Elizabeth Harvey, Vernon and I both witnessed Robert Lee Willie's execution. I was there as his spiritual advisor. Vernon and Elizabeth were both there to watch him die as the parents. And then afterwards, there were a lot of media people there, and the TV people came up to Vernon Harvey with their mics because he had publicly said, "I can't wait to see him fry," you know. And they said, "Well, Mr. Harvey, you watched Robert Lee Willie die. How do you feel now?" And he said, "It felt good to see him die." And then he added, "The son of a bitch died too quick. I hope he burns in hell." And I have been visiting the Harvey since then. It's like I realized he could have watched Robert Lee Willie die 1,000 times, and he still has to deal with the loss of Faith, his daughter, and that nothing can ever replace her.
Yeah. The first execution you witnessed was the execution of Elmo Patrick Saunier, who was also the first death row prisoner that you worked with.
Right.
Did you decide to watch or not watch when you were in that room as the electric chair was turned on?
When Pat and I had talked about it, first I was shocked that he was going to be executed. I just never dreamed it would happen because we hadn't had many executions in Louisiana. You know, this was in 1984. And so I said to him one time, I said, well, Pat, if you do die, I will be there with you. I want you to be able to see a loving face. And he went, oh, no, sister. He said, you know, that could harm you. This is going to be terrible. And I went, no. There's no question about it. I will be there with you. Then when I was actually in the chamber, I walked with him, you know, to the chair and read the scripture from Isaiah 43. If you walk through the sea, I'll be with you. God's words of comfort to him. And then they brought him into the execution chamber, and I was right behind him, and I kissed him on the back. I was leaving him, and I said, Pat, pray for me. And he turned around. He said, Sister Helen, I will. And then I went and sat in the witness chamber. And he could see me. He could see my face. And they strapped them in. They strapped the trunk and their legs and their arms. And he reached out his hand to me right before they strapped his right arm. And his last words were to me, I love you. And I remember my arm just raising up, going toward him, saying, I love you too. But then they put a mask over his face. That's to protect the witnesses from the sight of his face when the 1900 volts would hit his body. I knew he couldn't see me anymore, and he knew I was there. And so then I shut my eyes as they pulled the switch.
We're featuring a 1993 interview with Sister Helen Prejean. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sister Helen Prejean. Her 1993 memoir, Dead Man Walking, is the basis of the new film of the same name, starring Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn. The second prisoner on death row who you began communicating with was Robert Willie. And the first time you went to visit him, he asked you about being celibate, and he asked you if you miss having a man. Those strike me as really suggestive, intimate questions. And I don't know, I think if I were in your shoes, I would have really distrusted the motives of the person asking the questions. How did you handle it?
Well, Robert Lee Willie, I would characterize him as a true outlaw. I mean, he had a swastika on his arm. He belonged to the white Aryan supremacy. He held up Hitler as a hero. He said he hated all people of color. And he said to me one time, I'm not just prejudiced against blacks, but against, he named them off, Spicks, Chinks. It was just amazing to me, you know, hit the background and the way that he thought about things. And when we had that conversation, but first of all, I was really kind of hoping when I wrote to him that maybe he didn't want a nun to be his spiritual advisor because he said he never was particularly religiously inclined. And so I wrote to him, but halfway hoping, well, Robert Lee Willie, God, such an outlaw. Surely he is not going to want me, okay? But nope, the letter came back. He said, glad to have the company, and I would like for you to come. So I went. And actually, the tone of that conversation was, it was more he asked it to me really like an amazing question, that somebody would live a celibate life without sex. I mean, it was more like amazed that anybody would even try to do this. And the tone of voice in which he talked to me about it was, you know, one of, you know, God, I love women. He said, I believed in doing it. We'd get us a bottle of bourbon and a blanket. And it was not that you would have to have guests have been there to hear the tone of it, but he just said it in a matter-of-fact voice like that, and then he, and then that was when I said to him, Robert, you know, by my vow of celibacy, it's like, you know, it's not that I don't love anybody. It's that this way I can spread my love in the human family and not be confined to just one person and one family, like visiting somebody like you. And he kind of laughed and he says, yeah, he says, I know what you mean. And I only had 2 months with him before he was executed. And there are many very interesting conversations, which I tried to record very exactly in the book, because he was such an unusual person. And I'd never dealt with anybody quite like him. I was very honest with him, too, about confronting him with the heinousness of what he had done, the terribleness of it.
Okay, so here's somebody who's, you know, not only a white supremacist, but also committed these horrible crimes. And the more details you hear about his personality, the more truly reprehensible
Absolutely.
He becomes. So what kind of relationship did you want to have with him? What did you feel you could do for him? And what did you find anything in him that transcended all these horrible things that we've been discussing?
One of the things I did with Robert Willie was I was just very straightforward with him. I just said, you have committed one of the most heinous crimes imaginable to human beings. I mean, look at Faith Hathaway, stabbed 17 times and raped, and her parents. See, because one of the things that happened with Robert Willie is that Vernon Harvey was getting, he was holding his own press conferences and saying publicly how he couldn't wait to see Robert Willie die. And
Vernon Harvey was a step-parent of one of the victims.
The stepfather of Faith Hathaway. And so Robert Willie got into that with Vernon Harvey, saying, well, like, he's his own worst enemy, man. He ought to just let this go. I mean, he's saying he ought to let this go when, I mean, this was such a terrible crime. He and Joe Vaccara had participated in this. And I'm saying, let this go. What are you saying? Do you realize, like, what these parents have suffered? And then I asked him, I said, suppose somebody did this to your mother. How would you feel? He said, I would want him executed. I mean, he didn't even hesitate. And then he got off on the thing of that anybody that kills children, he would want to see them executed. Like, he had his own code, too. Anyway, and I just said to him, Robert, before you die, if there's one thing, it's you need to apologize to these people. You know, you need to tell them in some way that you're sorry for what happened to their daughter. And one of the things I bring out in the book is, see, the death penalty, he was fleeing for his life in a way, but trying to be tough because he's under the gun now. Somebody's after him trying to kill him. And I find that it's harder to experience remorse when he's in, like, flight with his own life. His own life is being threatened, and he knows he's going to die. So he's trying to put up this tough Marlboro Man front. And I think his harshness and the way he was talking about Vernon Harvey was part of that.
So, but in all honesty, it sounds to me like he doesn't have to put up a front. I mean, he is hardened. He doesn't have to fake it.
Well, a couple of things happened with Robert Willie, though, before he died. One of them was, at one point he said to me, well, okay, he said, one thing I do hope for sincerely, I hope my death gives the Harveys some peace. And I seized on that. I said, at least you're saying there that by your dying, you hope that they will have peace. And in fact, before he was executed, his last words were to them, and he said, I hope my dying gives you peace.
When you witnessed Sonia's execution, you closed your eyes. What about when you witnessed Robert Lee Willie's execution?
Well, it's like I had been through it once, and so then when I was with Robert Lee Willie, I was there as a witness, and I had more strength to me because I had been through it once, and I watched everything with Robert. I didn't close my eyes, and I watched, and as the current hit his body, see, they strapped their chin close, very tight to hold their jaw together, so they're really silent, they can't speak, and they have their body strapped in the chair, and as the bolts hit his body, his whole body like heaved in the chair, and the straps contained him, and I remember thinking to myself, it takes a long time to make a human being, and it only takes a few seconds to turn it into trash. Not that I condoned in any way what Robert Willie did. What he did was atrocious in any way that we can in our society. I do believe that people who commit such violent crimes need to be imprisoned, long-term imprisonment. But to watch such a premeditated, violent taking of human life, I was just so struck by how wrong that was. In the first execution, you know, Warden Maggio, when he announced the time of death, his eyes happened to meet mine, and he lowered his eyes. And, you know, partly what I tell in Dead Man Walking is my encounters with all these people in the process, from the warden, the governor, the head of the pardon board, and most of the people I encountered in that process who had to carry it out did not feel good about what they did. They felt some shame.
The electric chair in Louisiana has been abandoned for lethal injection. Many people find lethal injection more humane. Do you think it makes a difference?
God, I mean, I bring that out in a book. You know, if you're on a gurney waiting for three chemicals to kill you, one to stop your heart, the other to stop your breathing, or if you're waiting for an electric current, or you're waiting for a bullet, or you're waiting for gas, it's like the terror of death. The torture in the death penalty is the waiting to die. And Amnesty International has defined torture as an extreme mental or physical assault against a person who's been rendered defenseless. The Eighth Amendment forbids us to practice cruel and unusual punishment. And the killing of a human being consciously like this is the practice of torture. It is mental torture. What most death row inmates say by the time they die, they've been through the process maybe three times, being brought into the death chamber at times, maybe hours away from death, given a stay, brought back to begin the process over. And they say, you know, I am so tired, preparing for death, their whole family going through with. It's torture. We need to have the honesty to admit that we torture prisoners before we kill them. But the U.S. Supreme Court refuses to do that. And now with the lethal injection, see, it's like it's all covered over and made clean. In fact, an associate warden was saying at one point, well, the witness is going to be bored. He said, there's nothing to see, like you're watching somebody go to sleep. And they have like a hospital, white hospital curtain around a gurney now. They cover him over with a sheet. They're trying to make it look like a hospital, like they're putting somebody to sleep, like a horse or something. That's to save our own consciences, because it is torture and it is premeditated death.
Sister Helen Prejean, recorded in 1993, after the publication of her memoir, Dead Man Walking. It's the basis of the new film of the same name, starring Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sir Ian McKellen is one of England's most respected actors. In 1988, at the age of 49, McKellen publicly came out. Not only didn't it destroy his career, he was knighted in 1991. Coming up, an interview with Sir Ian McKellen. He's starring in the new film adaptation of Richard III. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews 12 Monkeys. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In England, Ian McKellen is considered one of the most versatile and gifted actors of his generation. He's now starring in a new film adaptation of Richard III that takes the story out of Elizabethan times and moves it to London in the 1930s. This scene includes some of Shakespeare's most quoted lines.
Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths.
Ian McKellen is an executive producer of the new film adaptation and co-wrote the screenplay. Most of his work has been on the British stage in classical theater. Perhaps he's best known in America for his role as Salieri in the original Broadway production of Amadeus, and for his roles in the film Scandal and The Band Played On and 6 Degrees of Separation. In 1988, at the age of 49, McKellen publicly came out. This was in part a reaction against a law passed earlier that year in England prohibiting the publication of materials that promote homosexuality. McKellen was knighted 3 years after coming out. I spoke with him in 1994 when he appeared on Broadway in his one-man show, A Night Out. That's night with a K. It's about acting and about being gay. I asked him if he was surprised to be knighted.
Yes, frankly, I was. I think I was the first openly gay person to receive an honour in Britain, and I took that as a slightly hopeful sign that maybe the world was beginning to grow up at last. I was happy to accept it as an actor because it put me, nominally at least, in the company of people I've admired all my life, like Sir Laurence Olivier and Sir John Gielgud and so on. But as an activist, which by that time I was, I knew in class-conscious Britain to be a knight was a very useful handle. And it meant that certain doors would open because I would have some social clout, and so it's proved. And
what doors do open when you're knighted?
Well, you'd be surprised, in my country at any rate, how impressed politicians are, even very senior politicians, by people who have a little fame and celebrity, and people who have a title. And it just means that government ministers, people right up at that level, are much more likely to answer a letter personally if it's on paper which is headed Sir Ian McKellen than one that just comes from that actor Johnny who I don't really know who he is. It just changed their attitude subtly and but crucially I've found.
What were your big fears about coming out, and did any of them come true?
I think what had always been a barrier to my coming out was the sense that no one would cast me, for example, as Romeo if they knew that in my private life it was Mercutio I fancied rather than Juliet. And that is, I know a lot of actors feel that if their audiences were to know that they were gay, somehow it would limit their possibilities of work. That really hasn't proved the case to me, but at 49, I was well established, and in fact, I've had more work than ever, particularly in films, playing, as I always have done, heterosexuals as well as homosexuals. So If that was the fear, it was, in my case, an ungrounded one. But the real fear was nothing to do with my career at all. It was, as I've been saying, the great pressure that's put on gays and lesbians, whatever job they do, to keep quiet and shut up and go away and stay tight shut in the closet. And it takes a great deal of will to realize that you're taking on the world by coming out.
Do you think it affected your acting at all to have something very important and very personal that you had to hide from so many people?
It's difficult for me to assess, but critics and friends say that I am a better actor. One of the reasons I became an actor was feeling inhibited about expressing that part of myself, my sexuality, in public and private quite openly. I was able on stage to indulge my passions and be very open about them and draw attention to them. And that's why I think so many lesbians and gay people who are closeted privately are on stage extremely passionate. I suppose, therefore, it might have been that when I reached the stage in which I was open about this very important part of myself, there would be no need for me to be an actor anymore. Personally, and I think actually that is true. I find as much satisfaction from my work as an activist and my getting close to the power structure in the United Kingdom to the extent of being able just to add my weight to changing those laws which discriminate against me and other people. That to me is as rewarding as any performing I've done on a public stage. However, I mustn't stop acting because it's only actually as a gay actor that I think I can be effective as a gay activist. I don't want to become a full-time politician. And actually, I'm so at ease with myself now. And that is the big advantage of coming out. There is nothing I'm frightened of anymore. That, of course, my acting has got to have improved, and because I'm prepared to go into every corner of my nature and my personality and apply it and put it at the service of whatever fictional character I'm playing.
I'd like to talk with you about your acting career. First of all, you really haven't done many movies. Most of your career has been on the stage, mostly the English stage, but some on Broadway as well, and Amadeus, for instance. Has it been a conscious choice to not do movies, or is that something you would have liked to do more of?
Thank you. That's a very kind and discreet way of putting it. I've spent my life trying to get into movies, and and here I am. The trouble is, with acting in the theatre, and it's about the only disadvantage, is that it does cut you off from a great many other things, including a stable family life, I must say. I mean, it's absolutely absorbing, and it's almost a 24-hour job. And long contracts and long runs make it very, very difficult to suddenly at the last minute nip off and do movies, which on the whole are cast at the last minute and you're not given much warning. And the only way to really try and have an established movie career, it seems to me, is to refuse to do the theatre for a spell. And rather late in the day, that's what I decided to do after I'd finished the United States tour of Richard III. When we landed up in Los Angeles, I said, right, that's it. And for the next 2 years, I thought I would leave myself open to film offers, and that's what I've done. And in the intervening 18 months, I've done, I think, 8 or 9 movies. But your audience may not realize that because the parts I've played haven't been very considerable. I feel I've been very much a visitor to other people's films.
Mention some of the parts for us.
Well, I was in Last Action Hero. Did anybody see that? The first Schwarzenegger movie not to do too well at the box office, I think. I was in A Lovely Western, written by a woman and starring a woman called Ballad of Little Joe. 6 Degrees of Separation, the movie set in New York. I've just finished a little English film called Jack and Sarah, and there are others that don't immediately come to mind, and I'm sorry about that. But throughout this period, I've been learning about how to act in film. Of late in the theatre, I've been increasingly working in small theatres. I suppose that all began when I did Macbeth for the Royal Shakespeare Company in 1978 in a very small theatre indeed, perhaps 120 people scattered around a circular stage area. And since then, I've realised that that's really how I like to work. And film is an extension, of course, because that's a more intimate form of acting still.
So what are you having to learn doing more movies?
I'm not having to learn in the extent of unlearn bad habits. That's not the point. Acting in the theatre is a question of selecting what you want the audience to receive, because an audience sitting a long way away in the balcony will depend on very clear messages from the stage in gesture and in exaggerated body language and vocal technique. They need to have the character presented to them. I'm more interested in having that relationship where an audience selects for themselves from what is on offer, and that means they have to be very close. They have to be able to see the flicker of the eye. They have to be able to see the thought behind the face and the body, and that means that in front of the camera, I don't select, I just exist, I am, and that is a different technique of acting, though, of course, the process of preparing for it is very much like what you go through when you're rehearsing for a play.
We're featuring a 1994 interview with Sir Ian McKellen. He's currently starring in a screen adaptation of Richard III. He's also in the new film Restoration. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with Sir Ian McKellen. I spoke with him in 1994 when he was preparing for a Broadway performance of his one-man show, A Night Out. For your performances this week in A Night Out, you're drawing from, it seems to me, everything that you know from your personal life and your acting career, and you're drawing both on personal experience and on plays that you've performed in and on other writings from people whose work you've performed. Might I convince you to do a short excerpt from the performance?
Yes, it's difficult to know what might be interesting to you, but here's a little section which will give you a taste of, although a lot of the show is hopefully amusing and ironic, this is at the heart of its seriousness, and I'm referring to at one point, the trial of Oscar Wilde. And this is what was said by the judge summing up. "Oscar Wilde, the crime of which you have been convicted is so bad that one has to put stern restraint upon oneself from describing, in language which I would rather not use, the sentiments which must rise to the breast of every man of honour who has heard the details of these two terrible trials. It is no use for me to address you. People who can do these things must be dead to all sense of shame. It is the worst case I have ever tried. I shall be expected to pass the severest sentence that the law allows. In my judgment, it is totally inadequate. The sentence of the court is that you be imprisoned and kept to hard labor for 2 years." And what he'd been convicted of course, was making love. And the gay poet A.E. Housman replied to that sentence and those sentiments on behalf of all persecuted gay people. "The laws of God, the laws of man, he may keep that will and can, not I. Let God and man decree laws for themselves and not for me. And if my ways are not as theirs, let them mind their own affairs. Their deeds I judge and much condemn, yet when did I make laws for them? Please yourselves, say I, and they need only look the other way. But no, they will not. They will still rest their neighbor to their will and make me dance as they desire with jail and gallows and hell fire. And how am I to face the odds of man's bedevilment and God's? I, a stranger and afraid in a world I never made. They will be master, right or wrong, though both are foolish, both are strong, and since my soul we cannot fly to Saturn or to Mercury. Keep we must, if keep we can, these foreign laws of God and man.
Thank you very much for performing that for us. Did you ever think that something awful was going to happen to you if officials found out you were gay? Not exactly as awful as what happened as the sentencing of Oscar Wilde, but that kind of like public humiliation and.
Yes, I think I must have done, and I think that was a real part of the repression of my life, which I deeply regret, and about which now that I'm beginning to understand it, I feel extremely angry about. And I think when I make public statements and when I try, along with many, many others, to get the laws which discriminate against my kind in the United Kingdom, I am fighting on behalf of myself as a young person, knowing that there are so many young people who are going through the same sort of feelings of repression that I was. However, the world is a better place than it used to be.
You grew up in small towns in England, and I believe your first exposure to the theater was traveling theater groups. What were they like?
I was a theater goer long before I was an actor, and long before I intended to be a professional actor. And I was very lucky to see a wide variety of theatre. I saw John Gielgud on tour playing King Lear. I used to go down to Stratford-upon-Avon in the 1950s and see the great actors Olivier, Charles Laughton, Paul Robeson, Edith Evans, Peggy Ashcroft in Shakespeare. I used to see variety theatre, vaudeville, which was still just standing up in England in the 40s and 50s, and at very close quarters, sometimes backstage. I used to visit these artists of various sorts, whether they were animal acts, conjurers, comedians, singers, and that world of stand-up comic has, I think, affected my interest in doing my own solo show, and some of it is deliberately uses the techniques of those people who perhaps I admire more than any other sort of performer, who can bravely stand on an open stage and entertain 1,000 or 2,000 people for a couple of hours. I think people who do that regularly for a living and for whom most of their material is designed to make an audience laugh must be the most exposing experience a performer can have. And those who bring it off, I think, have my admiration more than any others.
So you had the courage when you were young to go backstage and meet the people who were performing?
Well, I was very lucky. My father knew a man who owned a theatre, and that's how it happened. And so I, at a very early age, I was intrigued with the glamour of that secret which performers have, that they know what goes on backstage and they create what goes on stage. And when they step out of the darkness into the light, something magical happens, you know, that the henpecked husband suddenly becomes the man of total confidence. The slightly dowdy person dressed up in sequins and a bit of makeup on their face suddenly on stage becomes the most glamorous person in the world. And I wonder now, looking back, whether that didn't appeal to me because I was in a dark world of being gay, and yet on stage I was able to step out into the light on my own terms and attract the audience's attention and approval.
When you came to the classical theatre from small towns in England, were there things you had to change about yourself for the theatre, things in either your carriage or your diction?
Yes, it's to me a fascinating study that perhaps one day I should try and formalize into a book or something. But theatre acting, any acting, is about disguise, and at the same time, it is about absolute honesty. The characters one plays are not oneself, but they have within them aspects of oneself. And you're only ever going to be convincing as, let's say, Macbeth, if you examine that part of your nature, which is so ambitious you would be prepared to commit murder for your own self-advancement. You have to be able to imagine what that would be like and therefore look deep, deep into yourself. Now, that is being extremely honest in a way that most people are not required to be honest in their work. And at the same time, you are disguising because you are not Macbeth, nor do you speak in blank verse, which he does. The tension and between disguise and absolute honesty is a very telling one indeed, and I think goes to the heart of what it is to be human as opposed to what it is to be a non-human animal, because all the other animals in the world are extremely honest. They are always themselves, except when they're being occasionally devious and changing the colour of their skin to fit in with their surroundings. But their nature is very, very difficult to change, essentially animals cannot be changed. But human beings change and disguise themselves the whole time, and that's part of what it is to be a human being. In the morning, we dress up in a costume appropriate to whatever activity we're going to do. And when I was a young man, I thought as an actor, it would be limiting to be vocally, for instance, identifiable as someone from the north of England, and so I got rid of my northern accent to a great extent and spoke received pronunciation English. And I rather regret I did that, because I think probably on the whole there was no need to do it. An actor should have two sort of accents, perhaps, their own, their native one, and then something of a more general nature which they can use where it's applicable. But when I started out acting, I thought all actors should only speak with a bland, received pronunciation.
Sir Ian McKellen, recorded in 1994. He's now starring in the new film adaptation of Richard III. It's currently showing in New York and Los Angeles and opens in more cities later this month. Coming up, a review of 12 Monkeys. This is Fresh Air. Director Terry Gilliam first became known as the odd man out on the Monty Python comedy team. He was the American, and his main job was devising those surreal animations. Then he became a movie director, cutting his teeth on Monty Python movies, and then going on to direct his own increasingly sophisticated films, Time Bandits, Brazil, The Adventures of Baron von Munchausen, and The Fisher King. His new movie, which was released just as 1995 was ending, features some of the biggest stars in Hollywood, Bruce Willis, Brad Pitt, and Madeline Stowe. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of 12 Monkeys.
The year is 2035, and all the humans left alive are living underground. It seems a virus that began infecting people way back in 1996 wound up destroying most of the population of the Earth. In the absence of a cure, the only way out was down. Now mankind lives in a decrepit Terry Gilliam world, meaning lots of ducts and leaky pipes, lots of slimy cement walls, lots of antique-looking video screens, and lots of shots through distorting lenses. There are convicts under the earth, too, and one of them is James Cole, played by Bruce Willis, with a bald head and a haunted look in his eyes. James is unusually observant, which is why the underground government has selected him for a secret mission. They want to send him back to 1996 to find the source of the virus. It's thought to have been released on purpose by a radical group called the Army of the 12 Monkeys. But this is a Terry Gilliam universe, which means even the time machines don't quite work right. Before he makes it to 1996, James is unceremoniously dropped in the middle of World War I, and he also does time in 1990, where he's immediately thought to be insane and committed to an asylum. There he meets two key figures, a lunatic, played by Brad Pitt, and a psychiatrist, played by Madeline Stowe. Finally, when he succeeds in reaching 1996, there they are again, the lunatic, now an animal rights activist, and the psychiatrist with whom James falls in love. But by this time, as he tells her in this scene, James himself isn't so sure what's going on.
You were right. I am mentally ill. I imagined all these things, these people. I know they're not real. I can trick them. I can make them do what I want. I worked on them a little bit, and I got back here. I can get better. I can stay here.
You had a bullet from World War I in your leg, James. How did it get there?
I don't know. Look, you said that I had delusions, that I created this world. You said you could explain everything.
I can't! I'm trying to, and I can't believe that everything we say or do has already happened. We can't change what's going to happen, and 5 billion people are going to die.
I want the future to be unknown. I want to become a whole person again. I want this to be the present. I want to stay here, this time, with you.
That's a surprisingly touching scene, and Bruce Willis plays it with a kind of punch-drunk delicacy. He's the King Kong of this movie, a gorilla with a human heart. In fact, what's most startling about 12 Monkeys is that, despite all its helter-skelter time-traveling, it's a genuinely poignant film. Its inspiration was Chris Marker's classic poetic short film, La Jetée, and it also acknowledges Hitchcock's Vertigo. Like those movies, it keeps slipping from bravura action fantasy to a haunting reverie on time and loss. And as its threads come together, the movie winds itself around you. By the end, its grip is amazingly powerful. Madeline Stowe's performance is a bit hysterical, and Brad Pitt's is way, way over the top, although a lesser actor could never have invented his panoply of twitches and sneers. And there are potholes that make the plot bump pretty hard from time to time. Still, 12 Monkeys accomplishes what Terry Gilliam has been aiming for years. It's a seamless blend of gonzo satirical fantasy and genuine pathos, with each of those two apparently contradictory qualities serving the other. 12 Monkeys is Gilliam's best movie yet, and for me, one of the two or three best movies to come out of Hollywood in the last year.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, Chris Fraley, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.